Okay, great. It's a pleasure to be in this beautiful place, and I'm gonna talk about a series of, it's sort of a mix of different papers that I've written, with a variety of collaborators, including one paper that I wrote with Freddie, listed over here. So the basic thing that I would like to talk about is a new way of thinking about scattering in four-dimensional Minkowski space. And I want to stress that everything I'm going to talk about today applies directly to the real world. I'm not talking about any simplified model or any microphysics. Everything pertains to the real world. Okay, so usually when we think about scattering in Minkowski space, this is a Penrose diagram of Minkowski space, and we have past null infinity, where light rays come from, future null infinity, where they go to, and we consider some scattering process. And for most of this talk, there's a story about scattering massless particles and a story about scattering massive particles. I'll talk for about 10 minutes in the middle about the massive case, or more likely near the end. But at least for now, I'll start out talking about scattering of massless particles, which could be, for example, gravitons or gauge bosons. And what the problem is, you start at past null infinity, and there's a classical problem and a quantum problem. And you throw stuff in, it interacts, and stuff comes out. And we describe this by an S matrix, which schematically would be of the form we would label it by the momenta of, if we have an n particle scattering, we label it by the momenta of the incoming particles, the momenta of the outgoing particles, and of course the particles can carry other quantum numbers such as charge and spin, which I'm suppressing. Now, there's a sphere here in the past. Past null infinity is a sphere times a line. And I'm going to be labeling the points on the sphere by z and z bar. Advance time at past null infinity will be v, and retarded time at future null infinity will be u. Now, it's a statement which is free of any content. It's just a relabeling, reorganizing the way we describe the S matrix, that you can rewrite this as a correlation function on a two-dimensional sphere labeled by this same z and z bar. And instead of labeling particles by their momenta, we can label them by the points z1, z2, where they enter or exit z3, z4, null infinity. And of course, again, here as with here, there would be more numbers, quantum numbers, spin or charges associated with every insertion. And we can rewrite this as some kind of correlation function, O1 of Z1, On of Zn, on this sphere, which is called the celestial sphere. Now, one of the nice things about this, so Okay, it's free world. I'm free to draw this picture rather than this picture. But why would I want to do this? Well, one nice thing about this is that the Lorentz group, so here this Z, ZK, is equal to PK in some natural choice of coordinates on the sphere. ZK would be equal to P1K plus IP2K over EK plus P3K. Okay, that's given a particle of momentum P, that's where it enters or exits on scribe for some choice of coordinates on the sphere at scribe. Now, why would we want to do that? Well, because here we have Lorentz transformations, x mu goes to lambda mu nu x nu, or better, p mu goes to lambda mu nu p nu. But here, in this picture, Lorentz transformation takes z to az plus b over cz plus d, where a, b, c, d are complex numbers obeying this. So the Lorentz group acts like the global conformal group on the celestial sphere. And that is simply the statement that if you wanted to find the celestial sphere, there are many ways of going out to null infinity, which differ by boosts, and the induced metric on the celestial sphere will depend on the way that you do that. So it's the celestial sphere, so far, is only defined up to a global conformal transformation. So any set of correlation functions on the celestial sphere must transform in some simple way. Okay. Now the plot thickens. So that means that the S matrix elements written in this way must have some features in common with the correlation functions of a two-dimensional conformal theory. Now, the plot thickens considerably because, as we're going to discuss today, if we're talking about scattering in a quantum theory of gravity, one can show that this full conformal group, the global conformal group gets enhanced to the local one where z goes to f of z. So that in quantum gravity, the S matrix written in this way must transform under the full infinite dimensional local conformal group, which we know, and I'm just asserting this now, but I'm gonna sketch the proof of which there have been various versions. In a few minutes. And we know that those have been extremely, in the studies of two-dimensional conformal fields theory over the last 30, 40 years, those have been extremely constraining in the form and structure of the correlation functions. And we can expect similar things to be true for four-dimensional quantum gravity. So this gives us a huge amount of information about four-dimensional quantum gravity, which is completely independent of any microphysics. Yes, Lee.
Is the time information as to the retarded and the advanced time implicit in the coordinates on the two sphere?
Yes.
So you're assuming that they found algebraic in the fastest
way? We're not assuming that. We proved that. There's a link, there's a kind of matching condition where the advanced time ties into where the advanced advanced time and retarded time meet that links them together. And that sort of matching conditions is implicit in all known formulations of scattering theory in Minkowski space. And indeed, without such a linking, scattering theory is not defined. So now, why is this interesting? Well, there are a number of reasons why this is an interesting thing to look at. One is it's a proposal for flat space holography. In other words, that the S matrix for scattering in 4D quantum gravity, in a 4D field theory with quantum gravity, is equal to some kind of correlation function in a 2D conformal field theory without gravity. Now, I also meant to say here, even if we aren't coupling gravity, if you have a field theory that can be coupled to gravity, its correlation functions are constrained by this. It's just like we know that any theory that, the statement that a theory can be coupled to gravity constrains its structure. For example, we know that if you can couple it to gravity, there must be a conserved stress energy tensor. And this is a vast generalization of that kind of statement. It also tells us things about the structure of QFT4 scattering amplitudes. And also IR divergences, which I won't have time to talk about, but we just wrote a paper last week, and also black holes, which I'll touch on in the colloquium. Okay, so what I'm gonna do is, in this talk, is I'll start by sketching the demonstration in its most modern form of the Virasoro symmetry. And then I'll look at the case of scattering of massive scalars and show that the three-point function of scattering of massless scalars, when you rewrite it in this way, takes the form of a conventional three-point function in a two-dimensional conformal field theory. And finally, I'll talk about the fact that there's something called the soft factorization theorem in quantum electrodynamics, which says that any S matrix element can be written as a soft times a hard part, where all the soft and collinear poles are in the soft piece, and show that that can be very precisely reproduced in the soft piece computed using factorization. In this picture, using factorization of a well-known factorization of two-dimensional current algebras. Okay, so so what I'm going to do now, the first part, is show that there's a very specific operator which has the property constructed from soft, meaning zero energy gravitons, which has the property that if you insert it in one of these correlation functions, which is the same as the statement that if you add it as an external state in the S matrix, that that operator obeys all the Ward identities of a stress tensor of a two-dimensional conformal field theory. So I have to start then. The starting point is the subleading soft graviton theorem, which Freddie and I proved a couple years ago. So let me review that. So let's suppose we have an endpoint scattering amplitude. Now, with every endpoint scattering amplitude, we can consider an n plus 1 point scattering amplitude that depends on an additional momentum q and a polarization, which I'll take to be minus. And I'll write that as out q minus s n, which is the same as my original endpoint amplitude, except that I've added one external graviton of momentum q, and just to be explicit, negative helicity, which I'm going to let tend to zero. And now, what Freddie and I proved is that this is equal to s zero minus. So now I'm going to let q get soft as q goes to zero, the momentum of the graviton, s zero minus plus s one minus plus order q times the original endpoint amplitude. So what are these s's? Well, s zero minus was discovered by Weinberg in 1965, and it's given by the sum over all the external particles, all the external hard particles, everything but the graviton, pk mu, pk nu, the graviton polarization tensor, epsilon mu nu, divided by the pk dot q. Now, before I go on to give you s1 minus, let me note that this formula obeys an important consistency check. And the consistency check is that if we take epsilon minus mu nu to be a pure gauge, lambda mu q nu, we find that this S0 minus becomes equal to the sum of lambda dot pk, q dot pk over q dot pk. These guys cancel, and the whole thing is proportional to lambda, which I can pull out of the sum. Sum over pk, so this is proportional to sum over k, pk, mu, which is equal to zero by overall momentum conservation. So that's a check on the consistency of this formula. Now we have S1 minus. So S1 minus is equal to I sum over k, epsilon minus mu nu, pk mu, jk, jk nu lambda, q lambda, over pk dot q. So it looks a lot like this formula, except we've changed one of the momenta of the kth particle, which we can think of as translating the kth particle, to the angular momentum of the kth particle around the direction of propagation of the graviton. So that's what this thing generates. JK is the angular momentum of the kth particle. So there's sort of a trade of pk mu with I jk mu lambda q lambda. And notice that as q goes to 0, this has a soft pole. But this does not, because there's also q on top. So this is subleading in the soft expansion. And again, if I substitute this, I'll get pk dot, a cancellation of the pk dot, there'll be a contraction onto there. I'll get a cancellation of the pk dot q, and I'll get something proportional now to the sum of jk mu nu q nu, which will be 0 by angular momentum conservation. So this is the leading soft term is related to energy momentum conservation in a way that the subleading soft term is related to angular momentum conservation. Okay, now I can rewrite all this as a half 1 plus omega d omega a n plus 1, where omega is q0, the soft energy, the limit as omega goes to 0 is it equals s1 minus out s in. All I've done here is, because the pole goes like 1 over omega, this operator projects out the poles, and now I have an equality rather than an expansion, which I'll find convenient a little bit further on. Any questions so far?
Can you just remind me what's going on at the when p dot q goes to 0?
You mean the collinear poles?
I guess. Yeah.
You mean when pk dot q is 0?
Yeah.
So that's called a collinear pole. For massive particles, that can't happen, of course. But we are interested in massless particles here. And what we're going to see is those things become, when we're about to rewrite all this in terms of, so this formula here is written in this standard S matrix language. The question is, how do we rewrite this in as some kind of correlation function on the celestial sphere? And what we're going to find is pk dot q becomes a 1 over z minus w. So it becomes the pole. You expect poles in operator product expansions when you put operators near each other. And so we needed to have those things. Okay, so now I want to take this, as I just said, and rewrite it as something on the celestial sphere. And so I need to introduce some coordinates. And so let me just write retarded coordinates, retarded Bondi coordinates, in which the metric, so we have u equals t plus r, and the metric is equal to minus du squared minus 2 du dr plus 2r squared gamma z bar dz bar where this is equal to 2, 1 plus ZZ bar squared, is just the unit metric on the round sphere. So what I've written here is the flat metric in Minkowski space in, I guess, up here, where R, if we fix U and Z bar and vary R, we go up to future null infinity like that. Z bar are coordinates on the celestial sphere. And this so far, what I've written so far, is just the flat metric. But we're doing quantum gravity, so there would be corrections to this. It won't be completely flat. It will be asymptotically flat at large R. So the corrections will be a power series in R. Now, there are a lot of correction terms, and they've been a huge, studying them has been a huge subject in GR for the last, 70 years. And but the term I'm interested in is the term that they just saw at LIGO, the term that represents gravitational waves. So this represents gravity waves. So let me explain why, just qualitatively. First of all, this term deforms the metric on the sphere, because Z and Z bar are the coordinates on the sphere. But it's subleading. There's an R in front of it, but the leading term is R squared. So it's down by a power of R, as one would expect for gravitational radiation. Moreover, if we have a gravity wave going out to infinity, it's propagating along that R direction, and the transverse, the polarization of the wave, would be expected to be tangent to this sphere. And indeed, these things are tangent to the sphere, and it's also trace-free with respect to the leading order metric on the sphere. Okay, so we can think of this as the fluctuation of the metric, or when we go to the quantum theory, CZZ will be a quantum operator, which will create and annihilate, based on canonical commutation relations, and create and annihilate gravitons. So now we want to rewrite this thing on the right-hand board in this kind of language. And how do we develop that dictionary? Well, we can write something like, if we write Q mu is equal to omega 1 z plus z bar over 1 plus z z bar, I z minus z bar over 1 plus z z bar, 1 minus z z bar over 1 plus ZZ bar. This would be Q0, Q1, Q2, Q3, the Cartesian coordinates of a four-vector Q that points at Z, at the point Z on the celestial sphere. So Q is a null vector, and I'm just rewriting it here in terms of its overall magnitude, which is Q0. Times a unit vector. This is a unit vector. I could call this Q hat. This is a unit vector that parameterizes a point on the three sphere that's the direction of the three momentum. Okay, and similarly, I can take the momenta of any of these particles, and I have EK1 zk plus z bar k over 1 plus zk z bar k, etc. And I can also write a formula for the polarization of the graviton in terms of Q. Okay, so now, given this dictionary, which just is a matter of a change of coordinates, really, I am now going to define an operator, TZZ. You'll understand in a moment why I'm calling it TZZ. An operator constructed from a zero mode of the field which creates and annihilates gravitons, namely CZZ. Creates and annihilates them at null infinity. And the operator is minus I dz, where dz is the covariant derivative on the unit round sphere, d squared z over z minus w squared, dw bar, integral from minus infinity to infinity du, cw bar w bar, u du cw bar w bar. And then this is an integral over advanced time on retarded time on scribe plus, and I need to add another term on scribe minus, which I won't explicitly write out. Okay, so what have I written here? So as I said, C, its Fourier modes create, if I take a Fourier mode of C, or more precisely a Fourier mode of duc, e to the I omega u, du c w bar w bar, this would be a dagger plus omega. This would be an operator which create a dagger plus plus a omega. This would be an operator which creates positive helicity gravitons and annihilates negative helicity gravitons of energy omega. But there's no e to the I omega u here. So this is an operator which creates and annihilates zero energy gravitons, that is, gravitons which are at the soft limit. We can define this whole thing by sticking the e to the I omega, if we wish, by sticking the e to the I omega u in there and then taking a soft limit. But what is this u du doing here? Well, this u du term, if you trace it through, if you go to momentum space, it becomes a formula which I seem to have. Oh, no, here. It becomes 1 plus omega d omega. So the u du projects out the leading mode of the graviton, which gives a soft pole, and lands us onto the subleading piece. This here is something called a shadow transform, which has a long history in two-dimensional conformal field theory and is coming up a lot now in studies of the bootstrap and so on, and seems to be coming up all over the place in this subject. I don't really understand why, but there it is. And all right, so this is my operator. Now, the claim is that if I rewrite this formula in that language, I can write it in terms of this particular operator here, and it all becomes the statement that TZZ of z O1 of Z1 to On of Zn. And this is more than just a few lines. It's a fairly lengthy calculation. But it's equal to the sum over k of hk, which I'll define in a minute, z minus zk squared, plus 1 over z minus zk dzk, O1 of z1, On of zn. Or as I said a moment ago, that this is the covariant derivative on the round 2 sphere. And hk is an operator which acts on ok, and it's 1 half sk minus omega k d omega k. This is called the twist. Sk is the spin of the kth particle. If Sk doesn't have any spin, then this is just the scaling dimension. It's of the operator that's coming out at the point zk, not the energy, the scaling dimension. And so hopefully you recognize this. This is exactly the Ward identity of a stress tensor in a two-dimensional conformal field theory. And all the power of two-dimensional conformal invariance, there are different ways of phrasing it and so on and so forth, but ultimately it all stems from the existence of an operator that obeys all the relations between correlation functions and so on can be derived from this identity. And here we've landed directly on this identity starting from four-dimensional quantum gravity. Okay, any questions about that?
Right.
So, right. But even though it's given by a transform, it still has a local correlation function. And we're also noticing this business of the shadow transform seems to be coming up a lot. I don't really understand why, but we're looking at now the MHV four-point function, and written as, in fact, we've computed the MHV four-point function as a correlation function on the sphere, and it seems to take a very nice form when you do a shadow transform. Same thing with the QED soft factorization. And I don't really have an explanation for that, but it's coming up a lot, as it does in two-dimensional conformal field theory. I think that's something we need to understand better why this happens. Okay, so there's a question about this is a, Freddie and I proved a tree level theorem, there are some anomalies at one loop in this theorem related to infrared divergences. And there's the question is, how are we supposed to think about those? And we don't have a certain We have comments about that. I don't have a certain story of that. But I would say the following. There aren't really infrared divergences in, there aren't really physical infrared divergences in gravity. Gravity, in fact, is very weak in the infrared. There are powers of momenta in the coupling. And indeed, there has been in the last few years, it's been suspected for a long time, there's a formalism, the Fadeev-Kulish formalism, and also we wrote a paper on this last week, the Fadeev-Kulish formalism, in which you use a different kind of basis of states, and the infrared divergences go away. They're really a result of using the wrong kind of asymptotic states. And Freddy argued several years ago that that if you that the anomaly in the subleading soft theorem vanishes if you take the soft limit before you take the infrared cutoff to zero. But in gravity, there really you really don't need an infrared cutoff if you ride the use the right basis. So I believe that observation could eventually be made into a proof that that there are no corrections to this subleading soft theorem. Now, this also. So I'd also like to say that this idea that there should be a Virasoro symmetry in four-dimensional quantum gravity has a long history, and it has been arrived at from interestingly different viewpoints than what I presented here. I think this is the cleanest way to understand it. But it's been suggested by other points of view. And the first place where it was really discussed was in a paper by De Boer and Soloducan in the early 2000s. And they were trying to generalize ideas from DSCFT to get some kind of holography for Minkowski space. And what they did was they took and I think they were a little frustrated at the end of their paper, but I think almost everything they said turned out to be really right on the mark. They took Minkowski space, and this is going to come up in a moment, and did a hyperbolic slicing. Worked in hyperbolic coordinates. And then they viewed Minkowski space as a kind of, I call it a non-compactification, because it's a compactification where the internal dimensions is non-compact. That you can view Minkowski space as a non-compactification to ADS3, right? So these are H3, the hyperbolic Euclidean hyperbolic plane. So they viewed everything. They treated the extra dimension, let's call it tau, where tau squared is equal to t squared minus x squared. They viewed tau as a coordinate on an internal dimension, and then wrote everything as a theory in ADS3, or in H3. And we all know that theories in H3, going back to Brown and Hanau, that they must have a complex Virasoro algebra. And so they conjectured that you should write everything in some sort of basis appropriate to this kind of hyperbolic slicing, and then the S matrix would have a Virasoro symmetry. And indeed, that Virasoro symmetry acts on this sphere at null infinity. It's the same as the Virasoro symmetry that is acting here, this TZZ. I didn't say it, but obviously now if I take contour integrals of TZZ, if I insert contour integral z to the n tz z to the n plus 1 tz z dz that will, and insert them in correlation functions that will generate z goes to inside some z goes to z plus z to the n inside some contour, inside whatever the contour c is. So that is the same as the Virasoro symmetry suggested by de Boer and Soloducan, up to one important point, which is they thought there were two ADS3s and two Virasoros, and somehow they were scattering from one conformal field theory to another. But here we've only got one, and what we see from this identity, it's buried in these equations here, but what this is really telling us is that there's a matching condition here and here, which ties rigidly together the Virasoro action down here with the Virasoro action up here. So they didn't quite have a single conformal field theory on a sphere. They had two spheres, and they were somehow going to try to compute scattering from the one to the other, but it's really simpler than that. Now, on top, also, there was Banks and Barnack, especially Barnack and Troussart, who wrote many papers on this. That they were looking at, they went back and looked at the old analysis of Bondi, Messner, and Sachs of the asymptotic symmetries in gravity. And someplace in the middle of that calculation, you have a formula that there's some asymptotic symmetries which are constructed from vector fields on the sphere, which obey dz yz bar is equal to zero. And they were somewhat conservative, and they said, they took the conservative point of view that that we only take solutions of this with no singularities, which gives you the six global conformal Killing vectors, which correspond to the Lorentz group. So roughly speaking, BMS is Lorentz with semi-direct product with super translations, which I won't go into. And in fact, if you have something like yz bar is equal to 1 over z minus w, you don't get 0 here. You get a 2 pi delta squared z minus w. So BMS said that's not OK. Now, 20 years after BMS, BPZ, Belavin, Polyakov, and Zamolodchikov, came and for mathematically identical reasons, came to the same equation, and they said, whoa, this has an infinite number of solutions. Who cares about the singularities? Later, people understood why it was OK to ignore the singularities, but they just ignored it, and that was the discovery of two-dimensional conformal field theory and all its magical properties. So what Banks and Barnack and Troussart said is, hey, why did BMS throw all these out? They should be there as part of the asymptotic symmetry group. They called them super rotations. And again, it's the same as what de Boer and Soloducan have. They also didn't understand, they also had two Virasoros. They didn't understand the linking, and to see that there's only one Virasoro, which is crucial to understanding how, what the actual symmetry is of quantum gravity, you need to study behavior of things at spatial near spatial infinity. Now, it walks like a duck, it talks like a duck, but is it a duck? Is there some sense in which quantum gravity in four dimensions is a two-dimensional conformal field theory, where I want to use that term in some broad sense, maybe not unitary representations, maybe not local or something, but some kind of But of course, obeying some good properties like four-dimensional unitarity and so on, it would be very interesting to find some example of a two-dimensional conformal field theory that generated whose correlation functions could be interpreted as scattering amplitudes of a four-dimensional quantum theory of gravity. And there are a lot of things that look tantalizingly close to this. There's nothing that is exactly this, but there are a lot of things that look tantalizingly close to this. For example, fundamental string theory. We have a world sheet and we get the, if we compactify to four dimensions, we get the four-dimensional S matrix by computing 2D dimensional correlation functions. The CHY construction. Again, there's some two-dimensional calculation that gives four-dimensional. The ambitwister strings. There are various things that seem rather close to this, but it would certainly be great to have a concrete example of this four-dimensional, this proposed. Well, it would be a major breakthrough, I guess, to have an example of a two-dimensional conformal field theory that could be interpreted as a four-dimensional theory of gravity. Now, how much time do I? Yeah. What? How long? Okay. Yeah.
I have a question. What do you know about the De Lazar algebra? That is, what happens if you put two T's?
Oh, yeah, that's a great question. Right. That's a great question, and there are more subtleties there than you might expect. That has there's a simpler version of that question, which I think we've just made a lot of progress on with another paper 2 weeks ago on the soft factorization story. And the simpler version is, if you have a gauge theory instead of a stress tensor, and it's a much simpler construction, you get a current algebra. And then you want to ask what happens with double insertions of the current algebra. And that turns out we were kind of stumped by that for quite a while. One of the issues is you have to worry about a double soft limit, and double soft limits can have new information in them. But there were more subtleties than that. What we did in this paper 2 weeks ago on soft factorization was, I think, that we understood the problem in electromagnetism of when you put two soft photon insertions. And there you do get a level, and the level is a number called the cusp anomalous dimension, which comes up in other calculation. It's e squared over 4 pi squared over 1 over the cusp anomalous dimension. So having understood it for the soft photon case, I think we're well positioned now to go after it for the gravitational case. And there's an interesting question of whether the Virasoro algebra has a central charge or not.
Yeah, then you have to subtract somehow the infrared divergent vector. It's tied up with this issue of directing the vacuum. When you start to probe the second, you're already in the background. Is that part of the issue?
Well, we've also made very good progress recently on understanding the infrared divergences, I think. But I'm not sure, I don't, I'd be happy to talk to you. It's hard to talk about things that you don't understand. So my first answer to your question is I don't understand exactly how all the subtleties of the two-point function, but I'd be happy to talk to you afterwards about that. I don't see it quite tied into that soft cloud business, but maybe it is in some way that I don't.
Does any of the structure persist on the causal diamond, not having to go to square?
Well, that's a good question. I don't know. One of the things that why this has taken so long to understand, you might wonder why this wasn't understood, why Bonzi, Metzner, and Sachs why this wasn't sorted out long ago. I think it's very hard to see this kind of structure as the limit. You know, if you put the system in any kind of box and put some boundary conditions, it turns out to be very hard to understand it, to see how it emerges, how these symmetries emerge in the limit. Undoubtedly not impossible, especially once you know what you're going for, but yeah, I don't know how it would work on a causal diamond. There's an interesting antipodal matching story, which I haven't. Maxwell knew this, but in Minkowski space, and there's been some very nice papers by Campiglia and collaborators, and I mean it's implicit in all kinds of earlier works, but not generally appreciated that. The Maxwell field in this kind of situation, or the gravitational field, is very non-smooth near spatial infinity, but obeys, but not completely uncontrolled, as perhaps was once thought. And it obeys a matching condition where you match the fields at the bottom of scry plus, which I call scry plus minus, to those at the top of scry minus, which I call scry minus plus, with an inversion. So that the field, the Leonhard-Weichert potential has the electromagnetic field here. I'm going to talk about this in my colloquium. Here is matched with the field here. And so in a causal diamond, that wouldn't be a natural, in any finite radius, that wouldn't be a natural way to, wouldn't be a natural boundary condition. Okay, so I'm just gonna say a few words about, since I'm kind of out of time, about the two other topics I was gonna discuss. So, in this story, when you get to the right-hand side, translations are not, translation invariance is no longer obvious. Lorentz invariance is more obvious, but translation invariance is less obvious. And it's this Lorentz group which gets enhanced to the infinite dimensional conformal group. And when we do the standard scattering, we work in terms of plane waves which behave nicely under translations. But plane waves don't transform nicely under SL2C. They aren't in any standard representation of SL2C, like a highest weight representation or a conformal conformal primaries or anything like that. And you can see that by the fact that when we get to here, this operator is not, we're not working in eigenstates of this operator HK on the kth particle. There is a basis of eigenstates, which we work out explicitly, of conformal primary wave. So we studied the massive wave equation, box plus m squared phi equals 0. And we found a basis phi delta of z, z bar, where this is a point. So usual plane wave solutions would be labeled by a three momentum p, three numbers p, but you can label them instead by a conformal weight delta and a point z, z bar on the sphere at null infinity. And we found a set of solutions. They're related by convolution with the bulk to boundary propagator on H3 with the plane waves of the massive wave equation. Also depends on x. So I want you to think of these three variables as replacing these three. They solve the massive wave equation, and under z goes to az plus b, they go to phi delta goes to 1 over cz plus d to the 2 delta. Oh, no, cz, what is the convention? Cz plus d to the 2 delta phi delta. So these are what we call conformal primary solutions. And we showed that a complete, that if we take what's called the principal series, delta equals 1 plus I lambda, that these are a complete basis of the conform. In fact, Shao, my collaborators, Shao and Pisterski, just wrote a paper on the completeness conditions. And then we computed the three-point scattering. And what one finds is that the three-point scattering phi delta 1, phi delta 2, phi delta 3, the three-point S matrix of the fields in this basis goes like 1 over z1 minus z2 to the 2 delta 3 minus delta 1 minus delta 2 over z2 minus z3 to the delta 1, 2 delta 1 minus delta 2 minus delta 3, and then z1 minus a formula that should be familiar from two-dimensional conformal field theory. This had to work, but it was nice to see that that four-dimensional scattering amplitudes of an ordinary massive scalar can be reorganized if you just use a different basis for your scattering states to look just like the standard form of a correlation function of a two-dimensional conformal field theory. And the last topic, which I advertised but won't get to, is that, as I mentioned a moment ago in response to a question, in abelian gauge theories, instead of a stress tensor, you get a U1 Ketz-Moody algebra. So whatever this two-dimensional conformal field theory is, it must have a U1 Ketz-Moody algebra in it. Now, it's well known that in theories with a U1 two-dimensional conformal field theory with a U1 Ketz-Moody algebra, that any we can take any operator with charge Q and write it as e to the I q1 phi, where phi is the u1 current, jz is dz phi, and there's some levels in here, times a stripped operator o hat, and any correlation function factorizes o1 to on. We can write it as correlation functions of the stripped operators times some Ketz-Moody correlator. So if this is true for every theory with a Ketz-Moody algebra, and a four-dimensional abelian gauge theory can be rewritten as a two-dimensional theory with a Ketz-Moody algebra, there must be some kind of factorization going on in four-dimensional abelian gauge theories. In fact, there is such a thing, and it's been discussed for the last 50 years. It's been proven in the last 10, and it's called the soft factorization theorem. And the statement of the soft factorization theorem in QED is that any S matrix element can be rewritten as can be written as a soft S matrix times a hard S matrix, where the soft part contains all the soft and collinear poles. And so we showed that not only are these exactly the same thing, but the two-dimensional Ketz-Moody algebra gives an extremely efficient way. The soft factor in four-dimensional QED is a very complicated formula involving inverse, hyperbolic, and so on. And but it can be very efficiently calculated using the two-dimensional current algebra. So we completely reproduced that formula on the nose using the four-dimensional soft factor of the S matrix, which is known to be tree-level exact. We completely reproduced from this 2D current algebra perspective. So in conclusion, there is a rich and fruitful relationship between two-dimensional conformal field theories and four-dimensional scattering amplitudes in Minkowski space. At the least, it will provide us with some computational methods and insights, and at the most, it will provide us with a holographic reformulation of quantum gravity in four-dimensional Minkowski space. Let me stop there. It's obvious that there are poles when the points collide. Those are called collinear singularities, right? For the points on the sphere to collide, pk would have to be equal to q. So there are collinear singularities. What's not obvious is that there aren't other kinds of singularities. In other words, that it's a local CFT, that there can't be other kinds of funny singularities where they're at different points in the sphere.
But when you have locality, don't you lose a lot of the power of individual CFTs?
Right, so it remains to be seen how powerful this point of view is. Right, so we don't know whether it will be useful or not. Though I think we already saw in the calculation of the soft factor of the S matrix, we know that the soft sector is local, just by direct computation.
Thank you very much.